This is Age of Treason Radio. With your host, Tan Stoffel.
Yaki on Culture and Race, Part 3. I'd like to respond to some feedback that I got via the Daily Stormer, which reposts my podcasts. Someone signing as Schlockley wrote, "This is mental masturbation, no solutions from this Tan Jufel." In a sense, I agree with that criticism that philosophy in general and Yaki in particular is mental masturbation, in the sense that it's pretentious and navel-gazing at its worst, and it's reactionary. It's descriptive rather than proscriptive. It strikes me as a postmortem or as an obituary rather than as a manifesto or a call to action. Although Yaki in particular is actually known for having produced manifestos as well and for having been active politically in trying to realize his vision as how things should be. But I have dedicated quite a bit more time to analyzing what Yaki had to say than I had originally intended. And that's in part, as I've said before, that it's a lot deeper than I had thought it was. And I also have seen it as an opportunity to learn more about European history and racialist thinking. And it turns out in reading Yaki, it's a mixed bag. It's things that make sense to me, that fit with what I've heard and others say before and what I have myself have thought before. And in some ways, and some important ways, especially in the second series, it's much different than the way I see things. Yaki's views on race are iconoclastic. They're not what most racialists believe about race. The main distinction, I would say, between whites and Jews in this regard, as what it comes to mental masturbation, is the Jews actually have a leg up on whites in this respect, in that what we would call mental masturbation for Jews is just normal. Obsessing about their past, their future, their current circumstances is what they do. It's part of why they are so successful, and it's part of why we're not. It's part of why whites don't really think about what's going on, don't think about how it relates to what has gone on in the past, and don't really think about what it means for the future. We don't organize and we don't plan. And in part, that's because the Jews have to. The Jews do it because they have to as a parasitic people. Their main interest is in manipulating others in order to exploit them. And this explains an awful lot about why they do what they do and how they do what they do. And I'll go into that in future installments, solution to parasitism. But this is an important point, is before you can talk about solutions, you have to understand what the problem is that you're trying to solve. And that's the point of studying what Yaki had to say, because what Yaki is known for is diagnosing the problem in the most exquisite detail in his book Imperium and in other works, but especially in Imperium, and then in proposing a solution to it, which was Imperium, the union of European peoples into a single cultural entity. That's where I have problems, is in seeing it more as culture, as Yaki did, versus seeing it as a biological, racial issue, which is the way that I actually see it. And the thing about Yaki is that Yaki, unlike so many other commentators or analysts, thinkers, didn't restrict himself only to these vague terms like liberalism, but he did actually identify the Jews, as a separate group, as aliens, and as negative for Europeans. He actually correctly, in my opinion, identified the Jewish problem as Jewish parasitism. He identified them as parasitic, although he called them cultural parasites, because he very explicitly put culture first above biology. He put spirit and soul and ideas. But he did identify the Jews, and he called them out as Jews, and he identified what the problem was, the parasitism at the root of it. So in that respect, Yaki is more accurate than most commentators, and is worth investigating what he had to say for that reason. Now, rewinding a bit from what I thought I would be talking about when I started this second series about Yaki on race and culture, is actually later in his book, after he talks about liberalism, he gets into his concept of vertical race versus horizontal race, and how vertical race is this 19th century idea that it's wrong to see the nations of Europe as separate races, and to see race as this biologically rooted thing, and that he thought the future, the 20th century vertical or horizontal race was the way to go, and the right way, and that culture was actually the highest and first and most important thing. But I realized as I started reading that he actually lays out very early in his book the basis for these thoughts, and sort of summarizes where he's coming from. On page 10, he writes, "The great crisis of the West set in forcefully with the French Revolution and its consequent phenomena. Napoleon was the symbol of the revolution and its was the symbol of the transition of culture into civilization. Civilization, the life of the material, the external of power, giant economies, armies, and fleets of great numbers and colossal technics. Over culture, the inner life of religion, philosophy, arts, domination of the external life of politics and economics by strict form and symbolism. Strict restraint of the beast of prey and man, feeling of cultural unity. It is the victory of rationalism, money, and the great city over the traditions of religion and authority, of intellect over instinct." So these are the terms in which Yaki sees things, and these grand dichotomies, these words that he capitalizes, rationalism and money over religion and authority, even intellect over instinct. He sees intellect as a bad thing associated with rationalism and civilization, whereas instinct he associates with religion and authority and culture. We had seen all this in the previous high cultures as they approached their final life phase. In each case, the crisis had been resolved by the resurgence of the old forces of religion and authority, their victory over rationalism and money, and their final union of the nations into an imperium. And that is the thesis of his book, Imperium, right there. He would like to see the union of the nations into an imperium, and he sees that as being a cultural phenomena. And he sees it as inevitable, actually, as well. But we'll get into that. I think he's actually not being all that honest. I see a lot of what he's writing here as hand-waving. As I say, he has this very polarized way of thinking about things. He sees things as dichotomies, these very distinct forces at odds with each other. He anthropomorphizes them almost, as if they are gods or people, and sets them at odds with each other. You know, rationalism and money, against religion and authority, for example, in the section we just read. But when it comes to culture, he suddenly gets around the fact that culture is not biological, but at best you could see it as an organic, as something organic that springs from biology. But he wants to see it the other way around. He sees culture as the primary root thing, and that biology and people spring from the culture, or are controlled by, or an expression of the culture. You know, part of why I read so much of Yaki and go into such great detail here is I'm not trying to shoehorn Yaki into my understanding of how things should be. I'm trying to understand how Yaki actually saw things. And I admit when I see a disparity between the way I'm used to seeing things, the way I think is the right way to see things, and the way he describes things. And I would call him, and this is one important place to call him where I think he's in error, in putting culture first and foremost. I think he's wrong in that. He writes, and he does it dishonestly by mixing the word organic into culture. The high cultures belong at the peak of the organic hierarchy, plant, animal, man. They differ from other organisms in that they are invisible, or in other words, they have no light quality. And I'll interject here to say, or in other words, they're not factual. And Yaki is famous for his insistence on basing things in fact. This is another way, another sign, another aspect of his not being quite honest in waving his hands in this regard, that when it comes to other things that he's criticizing, he criticizes them for not being based in fact. But here he is talking about things like soul and spirit as if they're real and tangible, even though he acknowledges that they're invisible. Now, I can see a discussion of spirit or soul in a metaphorical sense as describing things that are intangible drives and even instincts that are unseen and hard to understand, hard to measure. But Yaki actually puts them out there as if they exist, as if those are actually the most concrete and tangible things, and that everything else actually springs from culture. They have no light quality, he writes. In this they resemble the human soul. The body of a high culture is made up of the population streams in its landscape. They furnish it with the material through which it actualizes its possibilities. So the population streams in the landscape are just there. They're just fodder to be used by the culture. That's, I don't think I'm misrepresenting Yaki to describe it that way, to translate it into plain English, what he's getting at here. A little later on, he writes, since a culture is organic, it has an individuality and a soul. Thus, it cannot be influenced in its depths from any outside force whatever. It has a destiny, like all organisms. It has a period of gestation and a birth time. It has a growth, a maturity, fulfillment, a downgoing, and a death. In other words, it sounds like an organism, and that's why he describes it as an organism, but then it sounds like life, too. It sounds biological. But he's already... He's making the argument here that it's not biology. He seems to want it both ways. He wants to assert the primacy of culture, this inorganic thing that springs from biology, and he wants to reverse the order and say that the culture comes first and biology is secondary. So in reading this, and I'm skipping around a lot, unlike in the first series where I read very dutifully just about every word that Yaki had to write about liberalism. I'm skipping quite a bit here, but I'm trying not to distort what he says. I'm just trying to capture the high points of what he says. And I'm wondering while reading all of this, so what's the crisis? If Yaki sees what's happening as just life happening, culture is organic and it's just going to be born and it's going to die. Where's the crisis? Why does he call this a crisis? Why isn't it just nature being nature? He writes about destiny. Why isn't it just destiny? Organisms die after all. Well, to get a hint of that, we skip a little further ahead here, and on page 62 he writes, "The proud civilization which in 1900 was master of 18/20 of the Earth's surface arrived at a point in 1945 after the suicidal Second World War where it controlled no part whatever of the Earth." Well, here he's anthropomorphizing the civilization as if it's a person, as if it's a man. It isn't, but that's the way he talks about it. And he's obviously disturbed by this very quick change, this very abrupt shift. And this is the sort of thing that even people who aren't as perceptive or as knowledgeable as Yaki, these are the sorts of thoughts they have as well when they look around and they say, hey, things don't add up here. Why was it like this only a short time ago, and now it's 180 degrees the opposite? The one that I can think of in particular is in Britain, how, you know, they had to fight the Nazis to keep them off their shores. And within a few short decades, now you're a Nazi if you try to keep aliens off your shores. To put it in very simple terms, that's something that occurs to many people. Well, here's Yaki basically making the same realization. Who really was the master of the civilization? He seems to assume that it was the European man that was the master. And so why would we be the master of 18/20 of the world's surface at one moment, and then after this war, suddenly be in charge of nothing? He goes on to write, "In 1900, the state system of Europe reacted as a unit when the negative will of Asia thought, by the Boxer Rebellion, to drive out the imperialism of the West from China. Western armies from the leading states moved in and smashed the revolt. Less than half a century later, extra-European armies," and he means alien, non-European armies, "are moving freely about Europe. Armies containing Negroes, Mongols, Turkestani, Kyrgyzanians, Americans, Armenians, colonials, and Asiatics of all areas. How did this happen?" Well, he answers right away in the next paragraph. "Quite obviously, through the inner division of the West. This division was not material. Material cannot divide men if their minds agree. No, it was spiritual division that brought Europe into the dust. Half of Europe had a completely different attitude toward life, a different valuation of life from the other half. The two attitudes were respectively the 19th century outlook and the 20th century outlook." So there he blames it, first of all, on a spiritual division rather than a material division. And he blames it on a 19th century outlook, which is his word for vertical race, or what he associates with vertical race later on in the book, and his, the view that he favors, this 20th century outlook of awareness of history and all of the things that he described when he was talking about liberalism, just as a microcosm of his book. This is wrong, in my view. First of all, everything I said about how Yaki acknowledges the Jews and recognizes the Jews and recognizes the Jewish problem as Jewish parasitism is nowhere to be found in this section of his, where he's noticing this meteoric change in power and in the reality of Europeans. At one moment, they're atop the world, astride the world, rulers of the world, and the next, they're not. Well, the explanation for that is, in a word, Jews. It was actually the Jews who ran the world. And the Boxer Rebellion is a good case in point there, that it was actually the Jews who ran the British Empire, that had the British Empire and the British troops in China to begin with, and probably were behind most of the other European military presence in Asia. The colonization of the rest of the world by European powers was not so much for the enrichment of Europeans. It was for the enrichment of the Jews who ran those empires, who financed those empires, and who profited from those empires. And when they decided that those empires weren't profitable anymore, or that there was something else that needed to be done that would be more profitable to them, and by profitable, I don't mean necessarily monetarily either. I mean as a race profitable. The way that the Jews think about things is as a group of what's best for the Jews. What's profitable for the Jews is another way to put that. Whereas it's European man that falls into the trap of thinking of profit as being a purely materialistic thing. That, in that sense, Yaki was right about that aspect of things. But here, he himself seems to show a sort of blindness to the influence that Jews had and the role Jews had in this 180 degree flip from Europeans being on top and in control to suddenly not being in control and on top anymore. So that's what happened and how it happened. What Yaki describes as the what of what happened is not actually how it happened. It's really just the what. It's that, yes, there was a spiritual division amongst whites, that the Europeans, the whites, warred on each other. That is the proper way to see World War II. That it was a disastrous war of white on white, and that the Jews won the war. Now, Yaki writes about the idea. I mentioned this in a previous installment, and he's somewhat vague about what he means by the idea, but it's related to his idea of culture as being primary. The idea is a property, a characteristic of this culture that he holds so high. And as we've already described, the crisis, he sees this as the crisis of the West, the crisis of civilization, Western civilization. Now we'll get a little bit more into what the idea is of culture and why he sees it as a crisis. The first step in action is thus the liquidation of the spiritual division of Europe. Since that was the diagnosis of the problem, that we're divided spiritually, his solution is that we have to unite spiritually. There is only one basis on which this can be done. There is only one future, the organic future. It's a non sequitur as far as I'm concerned, because it's spirit is inorganic. It's not organic. The only changes that can be brought about in a culture are those which its life stage necessitates. The 20th century outlook is synonymous with the future of the West. The perpetuation of the 19th century outlook means the continuation of the domination of the West by culture distorters and barbarians. Culture distorter was his sort of euphemism for the Jews. Barbarians are just other non-whites, non-Europeans. The task of the present work is the presentation of all the fundamentals of the 20th century outlook necessary as the framework for comprehending and thorough action. First is the idea. Not an ideal which can be summed up in a catchword or one which can be explained to an alien, but a living, breathing, wordless feeling which already exists in all Westerners, articulate in a very few, inculcate in most. This idea, and he capitalizes the word idea, which makes it pretty easy to find in his text, in its wordless grandeur, its irresistible imperative must be felt, and thus only men of the West can assimilate it. The alien will understand it as little as he always has always understood Western creations and Western codes. In his victory parade in Moscow in 1945, the barbarian exhibited his Western captive slaves to the jeering crowds of his cities and made them drag their national flags behind them in the dust. If any Westerner thinks that the barbarian makes nice distinctions between the former nations of the West, he is incapable of understanding the feelings of the populations outside a high culture toward that culture. Tomorrow, the captive slaves offered up to the annihilation instincts of the Moscow mobs may be drawn from Paris, London, Madrid, as well as from Berlin. A continuation of the spiritual division of the West makes this not only possible, but absolutely inevitable. Both the outer forces are working for the continued division of the West. Within, they are helped by the least worthy elements in Europe. This is addressed, however, to the only people that matter, the Westerners who feel the imperative of the future, capitalized, working within them. There's a lot to take issue here with what he writes. First of all, I would say what I agree with is this, sense of wanting to defend Europe, of wanting to, of sympathizing with the West, even though he can only seem to call it the West and doesn't seem to sympathize with the people itself and instead sympathizes with this anthropomorphized culture, this, spirit. He does at least identify the alien influence in this this long paragraph here. Some of what he says is prophetic. The way about the jeering of the barbarians in Moscow in 1945, and that this may not just be Berlin that's treated this way in the future. It may be Paris, London, Madrid. And in fact, that has happened. And it's happened in Moscow too, or it's happening anyway, that every major city in what anyone would call the West has become majority non-white now in its population. And that is a disaster for whites. It can be this idea that he talks about, this ideal, which he says cannot be summed up in a catchword, actually has been. This is one of the ideas. It's, you could call it the main idea of white nationalism, and that is the 14 words. We must secure the existence of our people and a future for white children. It's that simple. The Jews have an even simpler formulation. They call it, is it good for the Jews? That's how they judge everything, and everything boils down to that question. But we must secure the existence of our people and a future for white children is a good enough formulation of what Yaki refers to as the idea. It existed only after Yaki. David Lane conceived the 14 words decades after Yaki was writing. But it is difficult actually even to say for sure that the two are compatible, that what Yaki refers to as the idea is compatible with what David Lane described in the 14 words. Because nowhere in the 14 words does it call for the unity necessarily of all Europeans, that we all have to unite. And nowhere does it put white people sort of below this idea of culture as Yaki does. Yaki, by putting culture first, that actually is a great turnoff to anyone who actually is more inspired by real people and tangible things than this talk of spirit and soul. He writes, "Our action task is dictated for us by the fact that the soil of our civilization is occupied by the outsider." Here he is mixing again, these two concepts, civilization, anthropomorphized, and what he's outraged by is this occupation of that soil by aliens. It's an outrage because it's aliens, and it's because our people are the ones who are suffering because of it. The people, not the civilization.